There were all these doctors telling me I was fine. And in retrospect, I don't really blame them for missing the cancer. As I explained, I was difficult to diagnose. So then I'll tell you, I don't fault them for it all. But what I do fault them for was poo-pooing my fears and my worries, because that almost made me give up. And if I had given up, I'd probably be dead by now.
Welcome to Pause to Go, the podcast that's all about making the most of life's transitions from middle school through menopause. I'm your host, Bree Luck, joining you as we embark on a journey of self-discovery and questionable decisions. Get ready for heartfelt conversations, expert insights, and personal stories that'll have you laughing, crying, and saying, "Thank goodness I'm not alone." If you've lost your midlife crisis survival kit, we've got you covered. So join me, won't you? And together, we can pause to go. In this week's episode, I had the privilege of sitting down with the remarkable Cora Schenberg. Cora is a postmenopausal uterine cancer survivor whose path to diagnosis was fraught with complications. I want to prepare you. This episode does go into some heavy and graphic content, but it's an essential conversation for us to have. Cora bravely shares her story to shed light on the importance of being our own medical advocates, especially during the challenging stages of perimenopause and menopause. Cora Schenberg is no stranger to the power of storytelling, having published her work in the esteemed publications of Brainchild, Full Grown People, The Utney Reader, and Streetlight. By day, she shares her knowledge and passion for German and literature as a professor at the University of Virginia, and today she's here to share her own personal story, a journey of survival, resilience, the strength to speak up for oneself, and ultimately, love. But before we dive into this gripping interview, I want to extend an invitation to our own new workshop, PodCamp 2023. If you are a coach, a healer, or an educator looking to find your voice and share your message with the world, this workshop is your golden opportunity. Join us starting July 10th for a transformative 30-day experience that will take your podcast from concept to broadcast. Find all the details in the show notes. And now, join us as we pause to listen, learn, and advocate for ourselves and for each other. Cora's story is a powerful reminder that we have the strength within us to navigate the challenges that come our way. Let's amplify our voices, lift up one another, and together make a difference. And here is Cora. Cora, I'm so glad that you could join us today to talk about your journey through and beyond menopause. You have quite a story, and I think it's something that can be really helpful for other people with a uterus and with ovaries to hear and to know about. I'm going to just start with the question that I really like to ask everybody. How old are you and where are you in your menopause journey?
Okay, I am 65, or I am Medicare years old, as I've been telling people. I went into menopause when I was 51.
When you were 51. So average, that was an average age.
Yes.
For menopause. Yeah. Yes.
And if you're, I think what's also important to mention is that it was a delightful start. For 4 years, I had horrible menstrual cramping that just got worse as I had gotten older, especially in the perimenopause. It just felt like the periods were getting longer and heavier and yuckier. And then finally, when I was 51 and it finally dried up, I had not a single hot flash or any of the symptoms. It was just that pain was gone. So it was wonderful.
Thank goodness for some ease, right?
No, that was good. That was delightful.
What was your adolescent experience like? What was it like when your period started? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I was 12 and a few months, and I had some spotting. So I guess I was somewhat prepared for it. And then one day I woke up and it was clear that I had gotten my period and it didn't hurt. For the first, let's see, I was 12 and I never had a menstrual cramp until I was 18. In those years, the worst thing that could happen was I didn't feel any pain. And I had some embarrassing times when one time I was in middle school. And I was wearing these salmon-colored trousers, and I didn't know I had my period until everybody told me, and that was pretty awful. But, yeah.
Did you feel prepared for menstruation?
Pretty much, yeah. My mother had told me about it, and we had sex ed classes that told us about menstruation. And I also, I had a little bit of spotting in the months before I actually got my period. So I was prepared. And then I had some friends who were starting. And of course, in those days, when you got your period, they didn't have sanitary napkins that had these nice little adhesives on the back. You had to put this whole belt on that held the sanitary napkin in. And it was rather awkward in those days. But that's what we had.
I remember coming across those in my grandmother's house, in my mother's house, and really being very confused by them, thinking they looked very complicated.
They were.
So you got through puberty, and then you went through a whole adult fertile period, right? You had a child.
Yep.
Who is now grown, an incredible young man.
He's perfect. Aww. Perfect for me. Yeah.
Aww.
As a human being.
And now you are in a very different place. So you started to tell us a little bit about your perimenopause and menopause experience. Can you tell us a little more about that and take us to where you are right now, which has a really interesting and frankly terrifying journey. I want to warn people about that because it is a little heavy, but you're okay now. So I also want people to know that before we get into it.
Thank you. I'm okay now and I've been okay for 10 years. So yeah, that's the really good part. But I consider my story a cautionary tale. And if it has a moral, it's that you are the expert on your body, on your own body. As much as doctors know, they're not inside your body. So yeah, to return to the particulars of my story, getting my period and the perimenopause, it was messy, it was painful, I had cramps. And then when I was 51, it finally dried up, it went away, and I had no more bleeding, and I also had no menopause symptoms, which was delightful and surprising. I wasn't breaking out into a sweat, waking up drenched, or anything like that. But then we were at the beach. I was 55 by then and had been in menopause for 4 years. And my husband and son and I were all at the beach, and we were going to go down swimming. And I went into the bathroom to change into my bathing suit, and I found a trace of blood on my underwear. And I thought, I bet that happens all the time, and it's probably just a fluke. I won't see any more blood. And we went down and swam and came back and put on my underwear again, and I noticed there was more blood. It was trace amounts, so I told my husband, and we found a drugstore, and I bought just those little panty shields. I figured that's all we needed. And then at some point, while we were still on our trip, I did Google bleeding after menopause. And I was expecting to see, this is perfectly normal, but I saw one after the other warning, no, this is never normal. This shouldn't happen. if it were still the perimenopause, yeah, you bleed on and off, but I hadn't bled for 4 years, and you're not supposed to see blood when that happens. And so as soon as we get home, I called my doctor, and she wasn't able to see me, but a different doctor in her practice was. She said, "I'm so glad you came in. This is never normal." She took a look, and she said, "I can't see anything inside there right now, but I think you need to see your gynecologist." I went to my gynecologist when the bleeding didn't stop, and I told her it was happening. She took a look, and I was starting to feel this. It's very hard to describe, but it was a fear that something was wrong. And also, I felt this time pressure because this was August, and I teach at the University of Virginia. I teach in the German department. And I was going to have a busy semester, and I really didn't need to have some kind of GYN problem or any problem going on. And my gynecologist basically said, "Oh, you don't have cancer. It wouldn't present that way." And she didn't see anything. And so she said she would send me in for an ultrasound. So I wait for an ultrasound. The ultrasound result comes back. And she tells me, "Well, unfortunately, the tech didn't do a great job. So your picture's kind of foggy, but they found some fluid in this cul-de-sac between your uterus and your anus." I'm like, "I've got a cul-de-sac, like a dead end?" I didn't know this about the female body, but I said, "Okay, what's next?" And she said she was going to send me to this specialist. He's actually a fertility specialist. I know he's famous in the area. And he would do the ultrasound himself this time and see if they can get a better picture. So I went to him and he said, "Oh, you probably got some fibroids in there. I don't know. You probably just need a little progesterone to clear it up."
Had you had fibroids before?
I had fibroids before in the early 90s. In fact, I had the full myomectomy surgery for fibroids. They tried to get it with the small laparoscope, but they weren't able to do that. So I got a big old smile on my belly. Yeah. Bikini scar, I guess you'd call it. And so I thought, "Oh, last time I had fibroids, there was a big, long healing process." And so he said I should get a uterine biopsy, and he would send me to a colleague. And so between each of these doctor's visits, it's taken forever. And the bleeding is getting heavier, and I'm getting cramps, and work has started. And so I go to this next doctor, this colleague of the specialist. She did the biopsy, and I had to wait for that. And she said, "Fortunately, you don't have cancer." And I said, "Oh." And she said, "I barely got anything." And this is where I have to get a little bit graphic. The cervix is the opening of the uterus, right? That's where babies come out. And to do this biopsy, she had to stick some kind of an instrument inside there, a very tiny instrument. But it seemed like my cervix was made by the DOD, the Department of Defense. It's like she had a lot of trouble getting anything in there. But what she said was, "If you had cancer, all this nasty brown stuff would have come pouring out." And it just sounded so disgusting. And I'm like, "Okay, I'm glad I don't have cancer. But why am I bleeding?" And she says, "I don't know, Cora. It's a mystery. We may never find out why you're bleeding. You can always have a hysterectomy."
How did you feel in that moment when she said that and responded in that way? Like, "Oh, well, you can always have a hysterectomy."
I felt horrible. I almost felt like she was telling me that I was wasting her time. "Oh, it's a mystery." And it's not that I objected in principle to a hysterectomy, but to say it in such a gratuitous fashion, "Oh, you can always have a hysterectomy," I didn't want to have one without knowing what was wrong with me, if anything. And that was my fourth doctor. And if I could back up a little bit, I was having to wait for one of these doctors, because between each of these appointments, there were several weeks, "Oh, come back in X weeks" or whatever. I went to my regular doctor, who is usually extremely conscientious and sympathetic. At one point, I had had months where my only symptom was this extreme fatigue, and I was starting to think I was crazy. But she kept testing, and it finally turned out that I had mono, which if I had been 21, she would have found it right away. But because I was 51, she was, of course, testing for the things like leukemia that you would start with first on an older person, Lyme disease, before she found the mono. And I was really surprised. I went back to her and I thought, maybe I should have my iron tested. I was really feeling tired and crampy. And I was afraid, gosh, how much blood am I losing? It just doesn't stop. And she said, oh, you've just been dribbling for a few weeks, for a month. That's nothing. And I felt like an idiot. You know, that word dribbling, when I'm complaining to her about my dribbling. So I was already low. And then I went to this doctor and she didn't have any answers. And so I just thought, all right, either I guess I have hysterectomy or I've got to live with this. And I didn't like living with that pain, but I was almost ready to give up. I had seen, I think she was my fourth doctor, and I didn't have any answers.
You were almost ready to give up and get a hysterectomy or give up and live with the pain?
Live with the pain. Just keep buying all those feminine hygiene products. I was just buying them by the ton. And this therapist, a local therapist, James Yates is his name, he was offering a workshop, and I think he called it Throw Everything At It. He had been through a terrible experience where his wife had gotten very ill, and they weren't getting answers. And so he decided that after he had helped his wife by advocating for her, and through his advocating, finally getting answers, he would help us to either advocate for ourselves or find an advocate. And so I went to that workshop for people with either chronic or life-threatening diseases. By then, I figured I'd been bleeding for 3 months, and I figured that was pretty chronic for that kind of bleeding. And I said, James, I'm just ready to give up. I'm so tired. And he said, no, I know you're tired. And that's the way all of us feel when we get sick. But this is not the time to give up or to rest. This is the time to fight. He said, go back to your doctor and get her to tell you the name of another gynecologist. So I did. I was afraid she was going to poke fun of me again or something, but I just walked in and I said, I need to refer a referral to another gynecologist. And she gave me one. I made an appointment, and it took a couple of weeks to get myself in there, but I got myself in there. And by then, my file was really thick. But the doctor read it and she came out and she said, you have been through so much. And that was the first time that any of my doctors had expressed any sympathy, any empathy. I just wanted to cry. And she said, when Dr. So-and-so did his ultrasound, why didn't he use a contrast dye? That would have helped cancer show up. And he said, you have polyps and that they're harmless. She said, I think polyps with cancer inside it. And this other doctor said, you don't have cancer. But she didn't get any tissue. How could she possibly know that? And that's when I said, do you think I have cancer? And she said, I don't know, but these doctors are telling you you don't, and they don't have enough information. And she said she no longer performs surgery. She was close to retirement, but she was going to send me to a colleague, and he would perform another biopsy. And hopefully would get some results. I managed a month later to get an appointment with this other doctor, and he agreed that a biopsy was needed. And I said, how soon can we do it? And he said, my schedule is packed now. It'll have to be after the holidays. This was early December, late November.
So this started in the summer.
This started and now we in August.
Okay.
And now we're into December. And now I'm told that I have to wait till January for the next biopsy. So January finally rolls around, thank God. And my husband goes with me. And I'm feeling hopeful that I'm finally going to have some answers. And I saw a woman there that I know from my synagogue. It turned out that she worked at that hospital as a nurse. And so it felt really nice to have somebody I knew there. And so I go under anesthesia. I wake up and the doctor's there and my husband is there. And the doctor said, "I'm sorry, I couldn't do anything. Your husband will explain all about it." He runs out. And my husband says, "Once again, it's that problem getting the device into my cervix. The doctor thought he had gotten into a false channel and punctured my uterus." Okay. And so he didn't get much of anything. What am I going to do? I don't know. The doctor had left instructions to call him the next week. So the next week comes, Monday morning, I call. "I'm sorry, the doctor's out of town." I leave a message. Tuesday morning, I call. And I'm teaching through all of this. School has started back up. "The doctor's out of town. I'm sorry." I leave a message again. Wednesday morning, I'm having breakfast. And I'm just thinking, I'm sure he's out of town still. And I have to be very careful when I call because I want to be nice to the person on the other line because she didn't cause this delay. And so I'm thinking about exactly what I can say to this person when the phone rings. It's the doctor. And he says, "Cora, I'm afraid I've got some news and I'm afraid it isn't the best." I said, "What news?" And he said, "We found some malignant cells." And just then, my husband, who had been in the bedroom, walked into the room where I was, the living room, just as I was saying, "Oh, you're saying I've got cancer. What kind? What stage?" He says, "We don't know anything. It's in your uterus. It's possible it's also in your ovaries." And I said, "What am I going to do?" And he said, "I don't know. We're sending you to the university hospital." And that was that. So my husband was standing there and I told him that I had cancer. And I had asked the doctor, "You found malignant cells. Can it be a fluke?" "No." And I was thinking about a friend of mine. Mary was her name. She was a critical care nurse. For years, they had been treating her for what they said were fibroids. So they, come back every 6 months and we'll take a look. Just come back. It's nothing. And then one day we found out that Mary had stage 4 uterine cancer. And stage 4, of course, means that it had spread throughout the body. It was in her liver. It was in her lungs. It was in her back. And she was dead in a few months. She was 44. And I'm thinking about all these months that I've been waiting and going to all these doctors. And I said to my husband, "I hope these doctors haven't killed me." And so we just held each other for a good long time. And then he had to go off to work. And I had to dress to go and teach. Somehow we got through the day. But actually, before I went off to teach, the phone rang again. And it was the nurse from UVA. And she was scheduling me to come in, I think, the very next day. After these other doctors who were all associated with the other hospital, we'll come in a few weeks, wait a few weeks. But she was like, "Get her in there right now." So I had an appointment. My husband went with me. And so she said, "The first thing you need is an MRI. And I said, "When can that happen?" She said, "When do you get done teaching today?" I said, 2:00. She turned to her nurse. She said, "Schedule Professor Schenberg an MRI for 2:30. And so I was in for the MRI. 2 weeks later, I had surgery. And yes, I did have a hysterectomy because I had cancer. So I knew why I was having a hysterectomy. My ovaries came out too. And it turned out to be a more complicated operation than she thought. She thought once again that it could be the simple belly incision, but my tumor was too inflamed, so she had to make the larger incision. And I had about 8 weeks of recovery. And she said that she was going to do a pathology report, my doctor. And depending on that pathology report, that would decide whether I needed chemo and radiation. And that's when she explained about grades of cancer. I knew about stages. If you're stage one, your cancer is located just in the specific part. And as you go up in the stages through stage four, that shows how far it's spread. But the grades, there are three grades. And the grades tell you how virulent the cancer is and how aggressive. And so if I had one or two, grade one or two, I wouldn't need chemo, I wouldn't need radiation. But if I had a grade three tumor, then she would recommend it. And so I had to wait about a week for that pathology report to come back. And meanwhile, I could walk around and everything, but I had a lot of pain. We're sitting around after dinner one night when the phone rang, and it was my oncologist. And she said she had news, and I said, I hope it's good news. And she said, you had a grade three tumor. And that's the most aggressive kind of cancer, so we assume we got it all. But because it's so aggressive, even if one little sneaky cell got out, you're running a risk. So radiation will tackle anything that's there locally, and chemo will be systemic. And I said, when will I start that? And she said, after your healing from the surgery. So I had the 8 weeks of healing, and I'm one of the luckier Americans. I have an insurance policy that includes temporary disability, which meant that even though I couldn't teach for 8 weeks, I was still being paid, and the people who took my classes were also paid, which is a great boon, and which I think not only every American, but every human being deserves. But that's another matter.
It's an important matter. This whole time, I was thinking about how you must have had a very good insurance policy to help you through.
I do, thank God. Yeah. But I'll tell you, even that, when it was all said and done, and we're talking 10 years ago, when it was all said and done, when I had finished everything, if I had paid all those bills myself, it would have come to well over $100,000. And we're not talking about the physical therapy, the psychotherapy, and other byproducts of having had cancer. So I was lucky as far as finances went, and also, aside from having cancer, I was in good shape. I love to swim. And what my doctor had said was, you know, that most of the people who come in, not only do they have cancer, they have diabetes and other problems, and you don't have that. And so that helped me heal faster. And I was very grateful for that. Yeah. And
so you went through the 8-week healing process, and then you began chemo and radiation?
Yes. Yeah, the radiation in my case, not in all cases, but in my case, it was easy. I teach at the University of Virginia, and the University of Virginia Hospital is right nearby. So when I was going to have radiation, I'd be walking home, I'd run into that building and lie down on a table and get zapped, and then I'd walk home. It was nothing. It had some effects afterwards. I guess I can tell you, if you have radiation in your vagina, it shortens your vagina. So there's less room for putting stuff in there that you want in there. So that was, but I didn't feel anything at the time. The chemo was that pretty much would knock me out. I had, I guess in retrospect, I was lucky. I had, I think, 5 months of chemo. And I started to feel the fatigue, but I did keep exercising as much as I could. My hair fell out. And, oh, they were so sweet. There's a shop in the cancer center. It's called Flourish. They've got all sorts of things for women, clothes and jewelry and wigs and hats. And on the one hand, it's wonderful. On the other, it just shows you how prevalent cancer is. So they wouldn't have a shop if it couldn't be profitable. And cancer, especially breast cancer, is on the rise. In fact, everybody assumed when they saw that I was bald that I had breast cancer. And I would say, they're tiny, but they're still there. But I have short hair anyway, but just before my hair all fell out, I had it buzzed. And then I decided to go into that shop and see if I liked anything. And it was pretty quick, pretty clear that I hate wigs. And I did buy one kerchief, but mostly I tend to wear caps and hats a lot. So I just kept wearing what I already had.
And you've been rocking a pixie cut for a long time, too.
Yeah, I have. And I really enjoy it. Yeah. It was very nice to have my hair come back when it did. It's not just, what do they call it, a chenade when you shave your entire head. But there's this pale look that we have when we're getting the chemo. So, yeah, it was nice when that ended. And for me, that was relatively quickly. And yeah, so I healed and was able to go on with my life. And I am a writer. And while I was going through the chemo, I found that it helped to write, because when you're writing or doing any kind of a project where your mind and your heart are engaged, it's an anti-cancer. You're not thinking about cancer. You're thinking about solving these problems of word choice and paragraphing and what I want in my story. And that was a very good exercise. At first, I wrote a braided essay, and one of the braids was the cancer. And then I had another one that was about my relationship with my husband. And then the third one was my spiritual journey. And I kind of liked that essay, but my writing teacher said that he thought that if I wanted to sell that, that probably the cancer piece needed to stand on its own. And I said, okay, I'll try that, because at that point I did want to sell it. I felt this urgency that other women should know that they're not crazy. And I guess if they have a problem, that they know their bodies. If I could back up, there were all these doctors telling me I was fine. And in retrospect, I don't really blame them for missing the cancer. As I explained, I was difficult to diagnose because of the way I'm made. I had a big boy, an 8-pound, 5-ounce baby, and they still couldn't get those instruments in there. So then I'll tell you, I don't fault them for it all, but what I do fault them for was poo-pooing my fears and my worries, because that almost made me give up. And if I had given up, if you remember, I had this grade 3 cancer, and so I'd probably be dead by now, like my friend Mary. She's dead. So I want people to know my story, so they'll be encouraged to trust their bodies.
Has it changed the way you approach visits with doctors and self-advocacy for you now?
Yes. Yes, it has.
Tell me a little more about how you approach visits now that may be different from the way that you did before.
I try very hard to be professional and polite. But if I'm not getting answers, I might press for them, but then I'm not going to get blood out of a rock, so I'll go to somebody else. Get a second, third, fourth opinion. And to me, back at the time when I had the symptoms of what I now know was the cancer, I thought, okay, one misdiagnosis, two misdiagnoses, but can so many doctors be wrong? And the answer is yes. I had a relatively minor problem last week, and my doctor wasn't able to figure it out. She was very nice, but I went to another doctor who did figure it out.
It's very easy for us in many ways to trust the authority of anyone. Really, it's not just a medical issue, but in this case, it is. We have to remember that, particularly in the medical field, doctors are operating in silos. So their perception of an issue is going to be colored or supported by what they've already seen and the biases that come from that. If we're in a bubble, we make assumptions that that is how things are. And that's not, it's not the fault of the individual. You can love your doctor, you can have a lot of respect for that person, but it's also worthwhile to check in with someone who's maybe had a different bubble, had different experiences. And it just took you a lot to find those people. But it also sounds, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the first series of doctors that you saw were all affiliated with the same hospital. Is that right?
Yes, they didn't work in that hospital, but they had an affiliation with that hospital. So no, to be fair, I have some friends who swear by their experience with that hospital and not with the university hospital and vice versa. I think I had particularly good luck with my gynecological oncologist. I think the day of my surgery, my husband saw that a list had come out of the 10 best surgeons in the various fields, and my doctor was on that list. Mm. And I love her.
That's great. I also want to be clear, we're not throwing any doctors under the bus here. We're just acknowledging that the system is flawed, that we as humans have natural biases, and also that we need to check our own impulse to blindly trust someone because we think that they are an authority.
Yes, and the only thing I'll add to that, Brie, if I may,
yes.
We blindly trust because they think they're an authority, but also what I was saying is that when we're sick, we really don't want to be throwing ourselves out there and fighting. We want to be home in bed. When I had those cancer symptoms for what turned out to be 6 months, the best part of my day was the end of the day. I would take a bath, and water always feels good on a cramping stomach. I had these strong pain pills. Fortunately, I'm not an addict. So I would take a bath, and I would take this Tylenol 3 or whatever it was, and I would lie down in bed beside my husband, and we would watch something innocuous on television, and that's pretty much what you want to do when you're sick. But as James so brilliantly pointed out, if you can't do it, if you can't advocate for yourself, then hopefully you can find somebody who can do it for you. He did it for his wife. Yeah. Because in my case and in many other cases, it is a matter of life and death.
I'm so glad that you had that care. And I would also say to other people who are going through this, if you can find that kind of therapeutic care and supportive care as well, go for it. If you can afford it and if you can find it, please take advantage of that, because for you, it made all the difference, really. One final question. What is one wish that you have for other people who are going through menopause, for people who are having symptoms that are inexplicable or a little odd? What is a wish that you have for them?
I would wish that they pay attention to their bodies and I guess to their instincts. If they think that something is wrong, that they should find out what that is. And if I'm allowed to add another wish, it would be for support. Actually, this was another thing that James said. It's that latest research has shown that if you have a support system, people, a posse of people around you, where you love them and they love you, that it not only provides emotional strength, but apparently it also comes to bear physically. And I'm convinced that the love of, I mean, of all the loved ones in my life, my husband, my son, my dear friends, community.
Your spiritual community as well.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. my spiritual community, my synagogue. Yeah, that's incredibly important if you have that. Trusting in one's own body, because you're the expert in your own body. And support. Those are the things I would wish for others.
Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing your story today. And thank you for advocating for yourself so that you're here to show us how to do that. I am so grateful for you.
I'm so grateful for the chance to be on your lovely show and to talk to your listeners.
Thank you, Cora.
Thank you, Bree.
Here are my key takeaways from this episode with Cora Schenberg. Number one, stand up for your health. Cora's story emphasizes the significance of advocating for oneself in matters of healthcare. Trust your instincts, share your experience, and question authority. These are essential steps in working with our medical providers to ensure the care that we need and deserve. Number two, find support in times of turmoil. Cora's emotional journey before and after her cancer diagnosis highlights the crucial need for support and empathy. Support is not only about physical assistance, but about finding comfort, solace, and understanding in the presence of loved ones and supportive communities. Number three, our healthcare system is flawed. Cora's experiences shed light on the inherent biases that can hinder proper diagnoses and treatment. Recognizing these flaws reminds us to actively participate in our own healthcare, check our impulses, and advocate for ourselves. Remember to check the show notes for resources mentioned in this episode, including Cora's powerful article in Full Grown People. And don't forget to join us for PodCamp 2023, the transformative workshop that will guide coaches, healers, and educators to find their voice and share their message with the world. Again, as always, all of the details are in the show notes.
Here's my call to action for this episode. That's what they call it when I'm trying to get you to do something. I want you to do something, and that is to share your story. So if you would like to share an experience of your midlife delights, agony, or just plain humor, you can leave me a voice memo on my new website, pause2gopodcast.com. There's a tab on the right side of the website that says something like, leave me a voice memo. And you can. You can just record a voice memo for me right there and I'll get it. And if you feel comfortable having me share your voice on the pod, then I can share that with everyone. It's so nice to hear other people's voices. But if you don't feel comfortable having me share your voice, I can just anonymously share your story. It'll be great to have your stories on the Pause to Go podcast. All right, stay curious, y'all.
Thank you for listening to the Pause to Go podcast. Special thanks to Codebase Coworking and WTJU Radio for their support. This has been an Awkward Sage production.